This episode is made possible by Awin. Build, scale, and optimize your creator affiliate programs for maximum ROI with Awin. Leverage the platform's best-in-class technology and award-winning expertise in end-to-end influencer program and campaign management to your brand's advantage and drive impressive results. Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. This is the Friday show that doesn't really prepare. Right, Blake? So I had a meeting with Blake right before... No, that's such a lie. Right before this. And right at the end of the meeting, Blake, like half an hour before this recording, right at the end of the meeting, Blake goes, I've got to jump because I have a meeting in 20 minutes I have to prepare for. And then I realized he meant it was... is what you were talking about.
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm very prepared. It was just, I was putting the finishing touches on my preparation, but I was up last night, basically the entire night.
Good save. No one believes that. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, is Gen AI a solution in search of a problem?
If you understand what you're trying to achieve from the technology, then you will start to use it more and more. And it's just maybe we're very efficient people and we don't need it, right?
The shifting video streaming tides.
The aspect of YouTube and Netflix in particular, but also other SVOD, streaming video on demand services, having a great share of the time spent, that is about 40% of the story.
Where is the next ad battleground?
So that goes to show me that that's not super strong. So I think they're going to need to build out some sort of media ecosystem around it in order to get customers to engage in it.
Delivery expectations are shape-shifting, and the most popular American household pets. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our senior analyst, who's based in New York City, covers everything retail and e-commerce for us. It's Blake Droesch.
Great to be here, Marcus.
Extremely underprepared. Hello. We're also joined by head of that team and vice president of content, also based in the city. It's Susie David Canyon.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Hello, hello. And finally, we have one of our VPs of content covering advertising, media, and technology based just above where they are. It's Paul Werner.
Great to be here. And yes, I'm above New York, which means I'm hovering over New York.
You're not literally above it.
You never know.
Although when I last time I was in New York, I did look up just to check. Is he up there? Anyway, what we start with. Story of the week. That's where we're going to begin. We'll talk about Gen AI. Then we've got the new game, the brand new game. It's the second time we're doing it. It's not brand new. We'll talk about that later. And then we've got dinner party data. That's our random trivia portion. But we start, of course, with the story of the week. Is Gen AI a solution in search of a problem? Scott Rosenberg of Axios believes so. He says that Silicon Valley is still struggling to explain generative AI's utility. AI chatbots and image generators are making headlines and fortunes, but a year and a half into their revolution, it remains tough to say exactly why we should all start using them. He notes that the common rationale is, quote, everybody's going to be using them, so you might as well get on board now, close quote. New York Times columnist Ezra Klein says, quote, I consistently sort of wander up to the AI, ask it a question, find myself somewhat impressed or unimpressed at the answer, but it doesn't stick for me. It is not a sticky habit. It's not really clear how to make AI part of your life, close quote. Paul, I'll start with you. Is Gen AI a solution in search of a problem?
I think so. I think there are a lot of potential use cases, and there's an assumption that we're going to get there. But as of right now, some of the ways in which, at least in the world that I cover, advertising and media, some of the ways in which people thought AI would be very disruptive have not materialized. Instead, it's been useful in other areas. So as an example, the concern, and this gets to the point about image generation, the concern early on was that AI would completely revolutionize content creation or ad creative, and that people would lose jobs and that the whole process would be turned upside down. That really hasn't happened. Where practitioners are using AI is in measuring and targeting, in the more sort of like technical aspects of harnessing all this data. But in terms of like the creative process, that hasn't happened. So in some ways, I think it is, you know, the tool set is there, but the applications haven't really panned out. Of course, that could change tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I have so much to say about this.
Here we go.
Ready?
No, but go on.
I would actually say AI is different from Gen AI. In retail, at least, we've been using AI forever and a day, right? And it's always on the back end. I just think that the framing of that question is a little bit weird. And it's not that it's looking to create a problem. It's trying to solve a problem. And to your point, it's better understanding the difference between industries and people. So am I going to go to ChatGPT or any kind of random app to help me with my day-to-day? Probably not, although we are trying from a workflow perspective to use Gen AI in what we do. But on the back end, in retail at least, when you think about chatbots that are smarter, or if you think about Amazon that's doing like all of the reviews that are sort of rounded up to help you better understand the product through Gen AI and how to like bring things together to make your life easier, then I actually think it is solving a problem, right? And the problem is it's information overload. There's just so much stuff out there, and it's really hard to parse through some of that information to make an educated decision. But I see where you're coming from. It is not going to cause as much chaos as we thought in the marketing world when it comes to image generation and taking people's jobs away. Mm-hmm.
Blake, it doesn't seem clear. I mean, this point that Ezra Klein makes about it's not really clear how to make it part of your life, that seems to be a big part of the problem. Is it kind of feels awkward, like I have to go and seek it out to drag it into my life, as opposed to it being like, oh yeah, this is where this fits.
I think, you know, part of the reason why that is because it's not necessarily integrated into the tools that the average consumer uses on a daily basis.
Great yet. Point.
Once you start seeing generative AI, you know, chatbots or other, you know, functions on the homepage of Amazon, more prominently in Google or other search engines where it does exist to a certain extent now, I think that's going to lend to more widespread consumer adoption. And I'm talking about the way that consumers might use generative AI in their personal lives. Obviously, if you have a job where you're in marketing or advertising or retail or many other industries where you're using it for work, I think the use cases are sort of already there. And that's where a lot of this rhetoric around, you know, becoming prepared for and becoming acclimated with AI because it is going to be part of your job very soon. I agree with all of that. But I do think there is some credence to, you know, what Paul was saying about it does not serve a function that is necessarily ingrained in the natural flow of the way people conduct their personal business online just yet. And just one more point, I think AI is a victim of sort of the tech world hype train. So things got overblown very quickly on how quickly AI usage is and AI in general is going to scale up. That doesn't mean it's not going to be a big deal going forward, but I think it's still going to take longer for the average consumer to come around to using it in their everyday life than people in the tech world are assuming.
Blake is clearly not Canadian. He fully threw me under the bus without a U-turn at all. No, I'm
sorry.
Just joking.
I'm a New Yorker. I'll just talk for very long and not let anybody interrupt.
Yeah, I'm just joking. But you know what I would say? It's that stickiness factor that's critical, right? And no matter any kind of technology, and if you don't make it easy and convenient, people aren't going to be using it. We have a colleague who was telling me they use ChatGPT to say things like, and I guess it's just practice, right? And it's creating habits. They use it to do recipes. They try and figure out based on what's in their pantry and what's in their fridge, based on some of the different nutritional hiccups that her family has, what can she make that's 30 minutes or less? And then it goes and looks for recipes. I think if you understand what you're trying to achieve from the technology, then you will start to use it more and more. And it's just maybe we're very efficient people and we don't need it, right? But if you think about QR codes too, nobody was using them, even though they're like 15 years old, until we had no choice. So it might be that too.
Yeah, that's the other argument, isn't it? That a lot of people don't know what to use technology for until much later, 5, 10 years, 15 years later, and then it becomes apparent as to what they should use it for. The point being, get the technology into as many people's hands as possible, and they'll tell you how they want to use it. The one use case I could think of is for when you need to ask multiple questions at the same time. So for example, I was driving back from somewhere this past weekend and I wanted to stop off, but I didn't want to have to stop off somewhere for a coffee shop and then somewhere for a gas station. And I didn't want to have to like pull my phone out whilst I was driving. And so being able to speak to, you know, an AI and say, can you find me a coffee shop that's open next to a gas station within the next 15 minutes? And that would just add them to your directions whilst you're, you know, and not have to X out of that to go. That would be useful. And so those types of things, I think when it is directly inserted into the flow of your everyday life and helping you with certain tasks like that, that I could see.
Marcus, that's already available on Google Maps. You can add pit stops. I mean, you have to do it with your hand. You can't talk to it, but I bet you could, because like you can talk to Google Home.
You can add pit stops, but can you find, you know, a coffee shop that's open next to a gas station, or find a specific type of coffee shop or a specific type of gas station if you're maybe a rewards member or whatever? Something that makes it easy. Like you can do that stuff, but it's very friction filled, I think, even pulling out your phone and having to, you know, all right, find the option, add stop, then search the area. Those things can be quite difficult. Yeah. So if it helps streamline some of those processes, that's what we've got time for the story of the week. Let's move to the game of the week. Today's game, it's nearly brand new. It's the Super Duper game. How does it work? Great question. There are three rounds. Today we have slice of pie, move the needle, and the random scale. The better the answers, the more points you get. That's it. So, round one is slice of pie. Folks choose up to three reasons, up to, doesn't have to be three, why something is happening, attributing shares to each. So if the question was, who's most likely to derail this episode? I'd say 95% Susie, 4% Blake, and 1% Stuart, who runs the team not knowing how to work a timer. When Victoria's out, luckily V's here, so everything's going smoothly.
If Paul didn't get anything?
No, Paul's always good. The streaming tides keep shifting is round one. By the end of Q1, Nielsen's gauge showed that close to 39% of all TV time, all of it, is spent streaming things. 39% of all time. Cable was behind that with 28%. Broadcast had 22%. YouTube now accounts for close to 10% of all TV time, not just streaming. All time you spend watching TV, 10% for YouTube. Netflix has 8%, Hulu has 3%. A slice of pie, what's been the biggest story in video streaming in Q1, according to Nielsen's gauge? Susie.
Shoot, I think I did the exercise wrong.
Oh, jeez.
I thought I was supposed to say streaming 30%, whatever. I didn't know that I was supposed to say what's moved the needle.
Why would you have to do streaming 30? But that Nielsen's gauge does that for you.
Well, I don't agree with their gauge. I thought that's what you wanted us to talk about.
Oh, no. Their gauge is really quite brilliant.
Well, so I think, okay, fine. I can come up with it. It's totally fine. Can you ask the question one more time?
Okay. I told you no one prepares for this. We had a specific meeting, which we never do, just to go through how the game works.
Didn't understand the pie components.
Okay.
You mentioned pie and people just get distracted. They start thinking about pie.
Paul started naming pies in the meeting. It got very weird. Okay. What's been the biggest story in video streaming in Q1? If you had to give a couple of stories and their shares as to how big that story is.
I have to go first?
Paul.
So I'm going to say that the
off to a flying start.
The momentum in streaming is about 50% of the pie. The aspect of YouTube and Netflix in particular, but also other SVOD, streaming video on demand services, having a great share of the time spent, that is about 40% of the story. There's another aspect that Nielsen covered, which is that TV, traditional TV, had a very good January. That's a footnote, so I'm going to give that 10%. It's interesting, but ultimately it's kind of a fluke of, you know, NFL programming during that time. So 50, yep. 40, 10.
Very nice. Blake.
I'm actually surprised that, and I would give this about 50% of the story here, that YouTube doesn't have more ground on Netflix. Just to think of the versatility of YouTube as a platform and the types of content it offers to all of these different types of audiences, to have YouTube at 9.7% and then Netflix not too far behind it at 8.1% is interesting to me. The second story, which I would give about 25% to, is about just about, again, Netflix significantly higher compared to its competitors. So Netflix at 8.1%. And then the next largest SVOD platform is Hulu at 3% and Prime Video at 2.8%. I think when you just look at the way that content is spread out, Netflix doesn't really have a stronghold on sort of what I believe to be the consumer perception of sort of what it once was, just the place that had the highest quality premium video content. I don't think that's the case anymore, but it still has a larger share than its competitors. And then the last story, another 25%, is just seeing how small of a share of the pie some of these other streaming platforms have, all below 2%. Disney Plus, Peacock, Max, and Paramount Plus. Just for all of the hype around the launch of these platforms, they generate a lot of buzz, I think, in the cultural consciousness. But the fact that they still have less than 2% of the time is very, very surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to add up Hulu, Prime Video, and Disney Plus together to even get close to Netflix by itself. So that's a good point.
Are you ready?
No.
I'm ready. I think that's 50% of the story, how the presidential election and what's happening on school campuses is going to drive some different kind of viewership habits. I think that for me, there's a little bit of confusion, but YouTube doesn't create its own content. It shares other people's content, and it does have live TV from what I understand, but it doesn't have its own proprietary content. So I think this idea around the momentum that Paul is talking about, which is what Blake is talking about as well in some ways, creates 40% for content creation of streaming. So Netflix is of the world, Prime, Disney, that are Hulu, that are creating their own original content, 40%. And because obviously I have to talk about retail, I am shocked that the weather is a story for TV, and that depending on good or bad weather, TV viewership goes up or down, and probably any kind of streaming service. I give that 10%.
Very nice. Yeah, live is stripped out of these numbers. So YouTube TV is stripped out, and then Hulu with live TV is also stripped out. So this is just their YouTube main, as they call it, or Hulu SVOD. You mentioned broadcast, just looking at the numbers right now, really holding its own. The declining share is coming from cable to the benefit of streaming. Broadcast last February, 2023, was at 24%. February 2024 is at 23-24%. So that's really holding its own, the broadcast portion. It's the cable portion that seems to be going down and down. I had a few things that jumped out to me. Hulu overtook Prime Video from January to March of this year. So Hulu is now in third place in terms of time spent. Second thing, YouTube's gains. YouTube went from 9% of all TV watching to 10% of all TV watching, which doesn't seem like a lot, but in just 2 months. So it gained 1 percentage point in just 2 months. And then the last thing here, the new big three, YouTube, Netflix, and Hulu, first, second, and third streamers, make up nearly as much time spent with TV as broadcast. Close to those three players, YouTube, Netflix, and Hulu, account for close to a quarter of all time spent watching TV. Very good, folks. Let's move to how are we doing? Paul's just out ahead, but he does cover the space more closely. So he's up with three, Blake and Susie with two apiece. Next story is round two is Move the Needle. Folks have to tell me how much this story will move the needle out of 10. It's the next ad battleground. Apparently, it's going to be the backseat of your New York City Uber, writes Patrick Coffey of the Wall Street Journal. He explains that the New York City Council ended a long-standing ban on ads inside ride-hailing cars by passing a law that took effect in April, handing marketers a new substantial and captive audience for their video pitches in the country's largest market. According to the city's Taxi and Limousine Commission, folks ordered over 20 million rides just in February alone in New York City through apps like Uber and Lyft. So Move the Needle, we'll start with Blake. How significant of an ad battleground can the backseat of a cab be out of 10?
So I would give it like a, I don't know, I'd give it maybe a 6.5 out of 10.
6.5.
So basically, I think, look, it is the biggest market. It's a new form of advertising. Uber does have unique ways that they could leverage their customer data to, you know, have some sort of interesting targeted ads. But, you know, it's not media. So there's no incentive for the passenger to watch the ad unless they're interested in something else that's going to be shown on the screen. So I think that's why, you know, the taxi cab TV stuff doesn't really work out that way. And every time I get in a cab there, I don't see any ads. All I see is, if you want to advertise on this space, scan this QR code. So that goes to show me that that's not super strong. So I think they're going to need to build out some sort of media ecosystem around it in order to get customers to engage in it, or else they're just going to, you know, press that power button like everyone does when they get in a cab so they don't have to, you know, listen to Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, it is easy to ignore. The law doesn't require drivers to install these things in the first place, the video tablets if they don't want to. And then the screens have to include volume control or an off switch as well. Susie.
So I agree with a lot of that, but I would have given it a 5, not as high of a 4. Now, I think most of the time the Jeopardy questions are kind of fun, and that's just enough for me to get entertained, see a couple ads, and move on with my life. But it is important to have context around the ad so that people are paying attention and not glazing over. But even then, I just don't know that this is going to work. It's not new. It's not innovative. It's not a place where people want to be disturbed when they're taking an Uber. The only hope I give it, and that differentiates it from a cab, is that, like Blake said, they have a lot of data, both Lyft and Uber. So if they're able to target and have some sort of emergency, you know, urgent offer that you're going to take from the Uber so they can close the loop, and they know where you're going and where you're coming from, and they can give you a coupon to go to a restaurant, and then they can prove that it's worth the ad, then I think it's going to win. But there are a lot of ifs for that to happen, and so I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Paul.
So I'm going to say this is not a needle mover. I'm going to give it a 1. Digital out-of-home ad spending is less than 1% of total media spending in the U.S. And if you think about this being just a small sliver of digital out-of-home ad spending, it's a small blip on the radar, and it's an extremely annoying form of advertising. Most people don't like it. I think when people are in an Uber, they want to do other stuff, and having something blaring at them, like I know from my experience, I always shut it off. So I just don't think it's going to be a very effective medium. I also have to wonder, in the case of Uber, like, are they going to pay for the equipment, or does the driver need to pay for the equipment?
So the Uber drivers might, I don't know for sure, but they might have to fork out for maybe the tablet initially. However, the law's primary goal apparently is to create a new source of passive income for rideshare drivers, according to City Council Majority Leader Amanda Farias. Since it requires companies that profit from the new ads to share at least 25% of the revenue with the drivers. So maybe that's the incentive. They say, okay, you have to fork out for it initially, but we will give you a cut of the money. I'm wondering whether, would you click on a with ads Uber option for a 20% cheaper ride?
Yes.
You know how they have Uber X, Uber Green, Uber, you know, whatever, Black. Would you be like, okay, you know, we'll show you ads. You can't turn it off. You can't turn it down. It won't be blaring at you, but you get a 25, 30, 40% off your ride. Maybe that works.
Yeah.
Yep. And you just take your jacket off, pop it right over. That's great. Enjoy your ride.
I have a feeling that the discount might be more on the order of 5 to 10% than, you know, 25, 30, 40.
Yeah.
But
that's probably true. All right, folks. All tied up. Heading into the last round. It's round 3, the random scale. Folks have to tell me about the chances of something happening using the random scale. We're talking about delivery expectations and how they're shape-shifting. As of March, Walmart started offering early morning express delivery from close to 5,000 stores. Our senior retail analyst, Zach Stambor, notes the service lets consumers place orders as early as 6 a.m. that will arrive at their doors within an hour. Zach points out that the launch of early morning express comes about 6 months after Walmart began offering late night express delivery. The random scale, though, related to how fast people need things. That's the question. How fast do people need things? The scale from lowest to highest is, first of all, there's no real rush. Then there's within the next few days. Tomorrow's fine. And yesterday, damn it. So that's the scale. Susie.
So, of course, you're not going to love my answer. I think it depends, right? It depends on the category.
As soon as I come up with a question, I knew.
I mean, it's like,
no,
it just,
right,
it all depends on the category, right? But I would say probably the most important part when it comes to delivery is to make sure that it is very clear for your customer and to give them options to expedite, right? Just pay more. If I need it right away in the next half hour, then I'll just pay more for it. The onus is on the customer, and I think that'll just be so much better.
Blake.
I would say tomorrow's fine. And that's because I do agree with Susie that it really depends on the product. I mean, for personal care items, household goods, oftentimes it is, you know, yesterday. Like, you need it as fast as possible. I think that, you know, in the delivery space, my slogan is always that customers don't want fast shipping. They want free shipping as fast as possible. So a lot of the time, people are willing to wait a couple of extra days for their items as long as the shipping is free. But as Susie mentioned, you also want to include that option. You want the flexibility. So offering free ground shipping, an extra couple of bucks for next day, as well as click and collect. These are all the types of fulfillment offerings that consumers want, different consumers want, and the same consumer wants depending on what they're purchasing. So it's really all about flexibility when it comes to fulfillment.
Cool.
So if I have to commit to one of the four categories, I'm going to say yesterday, damn it, because
yeah, that's the whole point of the-
we live in an instant gratification world. But I will join my colleagues in challenging the premise of the question and agreeing with them that it really is about control and flexibility. So, for example, I love how Amazon gives you the option of putting things in fewer boxes and making a more efficient delivery if you're ordering a bunch of stuff. I think that speaks to people's concerns around sustainability, and it's a positive. I also think that when you have to change a delivery option, or when an item comes before it was promised and you might not be home, the ability to truly control that would be a big bonus. And that exists, but it never seems to work well. So like more refinement in the algorithms that allow you to customize the delivery.
Okay. Very nice. Let's count the scores. I don't need to count the scores. Blake won. Blake is this week's winner because of his "they don't want fast, they want free as fast as possible" slogan. Who'd you take that from?
That's a Blake Dirsch original.
That's a good one, I will admit.
It is a good one. I thought you were letting him win because it's his birthday week.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
It is.
I had no idea. I try not to.
Should we sing?
Things like that. No. Yes. No. We have no time for that.
Paul's but I will Butler. Say... He's good.
I will say, on the final point, convenience doesn't equal delivery speed, and people want the idea of people wanting like control and options. There was a separate piece from Zach writing that merchants must put shoppers in control of the delivery process. For example, letting folks choose a specific day for a delivery, which was an option 64% of consumers wanted, which can help mitigate their top concern, he says, which is missing attempted deliveries when they're not home, which was cited by 54% of people. Congratulations to Blake. He won just 8 points to Paul and Susie, 7 apiece. You get the championship belt and the last word.
I got to say, I'm a little bit unprepared because whenever I do the podcast with Paul, I always, you know, pay no credence to the idea that I could win. but I'll have to just say the Mets are a dumpster fire, but a slightly smaller dumpster fire than I think the fan base was anticipating. In fact, we even took 2 out of 3 from the Dodgers a couple weeks ago, Marcus's team, when we played them away at Dodger Stadium. So I guess let's go Mets and try and, you know, try and keep it above water for as long as possible.
Yeah, it's been more like a trash can fire, not a full dumpster.
That's fair.
That's what you guys are celebrating as Mets fans?
We do. We celebrate
a slightly
trash can fires. Yes, we do.
What's the Dodgers record right now, Blake?
Are the Dodgers still in first place?
Yeah, we're in first.
Yeah.
We gave you a few games out of pity.
Best team money can buy.
How come I'm not a concern, Blake, when you're on the weekly listen? Is it because Marcus never lets me win?
Not let's.
Yeah, I think you're, Susie, I think maybe you might be blacklisted against winning.
You're focusing too much on the plant behind you being in the shot as opposed to doing research for the show.
Thank you for helping with that. I was waiting for that. Thank you.
Well, let's crop that out. All right, folks, that's all we've got time for the game. Congratulations to Blake. He is the winner, not Susie. Time now for dinner party data. It's the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Let's start with Blake, because he won.
So I had a report come out last week.
This is not that time.
Restaurant digitization.
Self-promotion.
This is fun data, though. It would be a big miss for me to talk about like restaurant data without plugging my report. So okay. It's funny that you think I'm so prepared for these podcasts that I specifically found restaurant data so I could plug my report. That is by no means what happened. I looked up, I went to the first website I always go to for dinner party data and found this 2 minutes before we started recording.
YouGov?
Happened to be. Yeah, so this is some data from YouGov.
Here we go.
They polled Americans. I do like YouGov. I think they always have like the most interesting survey. It's a great firm. Which restaurant customer behavior do Americans think are acceptable and unacceptable? And in typical YouGov fashion, there's a long list that I cannot, you know, I'm not going to read off. So I'll give you is the most unacceptable behavior that a customer does. So it's not just their interaction with the staff. It's also like socially too. So 90% said it was unacceptable to say they won't pay for a dish they didn't like, but they ate it. Some of the other most unacceptable behaviors were allowing children to roam freely, debating menu prices with the staff.
Kids.
Weird.
Stop.
Staying past the restaurant's closing time. It's understandable. Also snap their fingers to get the waiter's attention. That's really tough.
I always have my butler do it. I would never do that myself.
No, exactly.
Debating prices with the staff is pretty baller. Be like, I'll give you 15 for it, tops. 16 is my final offer.
Everything's a negotiation.
Like, it's a steak, sir. Susie, you're up.
So today is National Write a Review Day, and we know that reviews help with conversion. 76% of consumers express that they trust reviews, and 91% of consumers say they read them before they make a purchase. So it's really important to maintain trust with your consumer by having really good, credible, not bought reviews. 50% of consumers tend to show greater interest in a business if they respond to the review and they feel like it's a better sort of interaction and the business cares for them. And the last piece I will leave you, which should not be a surprise, which is probably why Amazon is using Gen AI for reviews and trying to sum them up. 65% of consumers use Amazon for online reviews.
Very nice.
Write a review. It's really important, especially for small businesses and restaurants.
Or small podcasts. Thank you to everyone who has reviewed this podcast. Paul, you're up.
So what is the windiest city in the U.S.?
It's not Chicago.
Chicago's not even in the top 10.
That's because it's not the windy city because of the wind.
Right. So the windiest city in the U.S. is Amarillo, Texas.
I was going to guess somewhere in Montana.
Oh, sorry. I should have let you guys guess first.
No, it's fine.
Rochester, Minnesota, number 2. Lubbock, Texas, number 3. Corpus Christi, Texas, number 4. And Wichita, Kansas, number 5. This got me thinking, though. And by the way, all of this started because Apple has made the weather app a lot more sophisticated in the last couple of iterations. But this got me thinking, what are the least windy cities in the U.S.? And there's actually a 3-way tie, but they're all in one state. So anyone want to guess the state? Don't all shout at once.
It must be in the middle of the country. Where there's no like lakes.
Does it count when there's a hurricane?
Well, that's a complicated question. Hurricanes do count, but ironically, tornadoes don't because...
Georgia.
Let me just finish, because tornadoes typically destroy the measurement data, so it's harder to measure the actual wind speed of tornadoes, so they factor that out of these averages. But so, Marcus, you said Georgia.
Only if it's correct.
And then...
We'll cut out otherwise.
And then Blake, you...
I'm going to say Alabama.
Okay, and Susie, you said it would be around the middle of the country?
Yeah.
You're all wrong.
Midwest.
You're all wrong. Oh. Southwest, Arizona.
Arizona.
It is so dry there.
Yeah. Catalina Foothills, Tucson, and Casa Adobes are the 3 cities with an average wind speed of 1.1 miles per hour.
All right. Let's do a clean take so I can cut this in. Arizona.
Nice try.
All right. Thanks, Lance.
Yeah, you win, Marcus.
I got one for you real quick. The most popular American household pets, according to the American Pet Products Association. In a recent Visual Capitalist article by Marcus Liu, he writes that Guess, well, you probably know what it is.
Fish.
Guess how many people, the most popular. Oh. No, it's not fish. It is, of course.
Ducks.
There we go. But what share of American households have a dog?
20.
1 in 2.
40.
50. 20, 40, 1 in 2. It is exactly 50%, yeah. 65 million households own a dog. 50% of all US households. Then it's cats. This is too high, this one. 37% of all households owning those, especially considering that, is it 96% of a cat's DNA is lion? What did Minda say? It was something like that. Basically, cats are lions is what she was saying. Now, I walked past a cat yesterday and crossed the street because I was like, I look at you differently now.
Wait, there was a cat on the street where you were?
No, Marcus looked at a cat inside a house and then he went outside to cross the street.
You've never seen a cat outside? What are we doing?
Not in the U.S.
I've never seen a stray cat.
Or just a New York cat?
That's just outside. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I mean, not like in Manhattan, you're not likely to see one. Maybe a bodega cat, but in the suburbs, yeah.
All right.
No, I've never seen that before. I've seen it in Greece everywhere.
You said that like I said polar bear.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Counts a second, 37%. 8% have freshwater fish. Just over 5% have small animals, rabbits, hamsters, guinea pigs. And just under 5% have birds and reptiles. Hmm. 1.5% have horses, and 1.5% have saltwater fish.
I assume that my last pet doesn't even figure into the ranking at all. Eels?
What did you have last?
Eel.
Did you really have an eel?
I did.
Did your kids make you?
My brother.
Your choice?
My brother worked in a restaurant where they cooked little elvers, little tiny eels.
Come on.
And there was one that was
a different color.
So it was actually a victim of discrimination. So he brought it to my, he had the key to my apartment.
Oh, I do remember.
Yes, he brought it to my apartment, put it in a bowl, and said, here's Herman, take care of him. And I did. And Herman grew up a lot.
Have you seen a stray cat in your neighborhood? I mean, you're the one that lives in a house compared to all of us here. Do you see
cats outside all the time?
Roaming around your neighborhood?
They don't have to be stray to be outside. They go through a cat
outdoor flap
at the back of your house, yeah. And then they come back in.
I mean, my parents did adopt a stray cat 20 years ago in Canada. So
we had stray cats in my neighborhood in the suburbs, and they were actually kind of circling our property. Which
stray?
Well, these were stray, but I agree. I agree that yes, we do see cats, like real cats that are not stray cats.
I forgot
take
about
off running if she sees a cat outside.
I did. I forgot that my parents adopted a stray cat. They even got him a cage, named him and everything, got him food because. He was, I think he was being attacked by raccoons.
Good God. You said that like it was very pointed, like you owed them money.
No, I felt
all right.
That.
Two more things for you. Dog owners will understand this. A Forbes advisor analysis found the essential dog expenses cost an average of $1,500 annually. That's too much.
I thought it would be so much.
And Forbes found that 66%.
I thought you were going to say $1,500 a month.
Yeah.
No. Forbes found, it depends, if something happens to the dog and you've got to take it to the vet, then that can shoot up quite, it probably doubles very quickly. Forbes found that 66% of all American households own at least one pet. That's up 10 points from 1988, 56. And one third of US households own multiple. In England, my mum is responsible for at least half of the dog ownership in the country. We have four. I'd say it's too many, but it's not enough. That's what we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you to Susie.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Blake.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you to Victoria, who edits the show. And Stuart, who runs the team. Sophie, who does our social media. Lance, who runs our video podcast. Thanks to everyone for listening in. We hope to see you on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Walmart Connect. Happiest of weekends.
Guys, should I click on a thing called Zuma's blog or no? Weeza Zoo's blog. Does that sound like it could be a hack in the making?
Yeah. You've got to stop with the IT questions, okay?
Want to be safe. Safety first.
What have you been doing on the internet that you're getting all this stuff on your machine? Get a Mac, for the love of God.
No. Hard. I think I found one. Trust Pulse. I mean, it's in the name. Trust Pulse.
Yeah, if it says trust, you can definitely trust it. Rule of thumb. If somebody says trust me, go for it.
I better click on the Zoo link.
Oh, God.